Okay, so last time we had a look at wireless local area networks, so one of the most common wireless technologies around and is embodied by the 802.11 family standards, and then the demonstrator was in to talk to you about NS3 and your project, and hopefully that was useful in getting you started. Okay. So we're now going to spend a few lectures looking at cellular network technology, and so it's telephony related and hence complex enough. Okay. What we'll look at today is just the idea of how we achieve coverage for cellular networks, and then possibly, at least for that coverage, analyze sort of the capacity of those networks. Okay. Okay, so the Stallings reference is primary, and again, these are old references, but this basic coverage issue the basic idea behind, sort of again, how you arrange coverage hasn't changed. Obviously, the technology by which you achieve your wireless connection and the purpose for which you're doing it has changed a fair amount in 10 plus years. But today we're just looking at, again, sort of basic theory, and then we'll move on later to sort of wend our way through the technology, the actual technology of cellular systems. Okay, so we're just going to try and get a basic picture of how cellular networks work, and so that'll have to do with the organization, how we arrange ourselves, and then how we make connections for mobile users within those cells. Okay. We'll then dig in a bit to the concept of cellular design and arranging the cells so that at least certain basic constraints are met. Talk a bit about power control within the cells, and we've mentioned that before in terms of spread spectrum and having to equalize power for receivers. And then we'll look at analyzing what the capacity of the cells are, how many users can you have per cell, and then various modifications to our basic design that will allow us to perhaps cater for an increasing number of users. So, cellular networks arose from telephony networks. And so their goal was initially to allow for voice connectivity, but with large-scale coverage and mobility being the main goals. Low power consumption, so if you have you achieve mobility through having battery-operated devices, and so you need to try and at least to some extent minimize your power consumption. And we then achieve our coverage through the reuse of our spectrum, with the basic idea being if you're far enough away, if two users are far enough away from each other, then they can use the same frequencies without significant interference. Okay, so the basic idea is that we only have so much spectrum, and and any given access point is only going to have a certain range. What the range is going to be dependent on how much power you're willing to pump into your transmission, but you're not going to go forever. And so obviously what this means is you need multiple access points to achieve coverage, but we can start reusing our spectrum on channels as long, again, as the access points are sufficiently far away from each other. Okay. So we define a cell as the region in which a channel is used. So it's the range of a certain access point in the cellular systems. We call access points base stations. And basically, each base station is going to get some subset of the spectrum to use, and we want to make sure that at least neighboring base stations aren't getting the same spectrum. Okay, so you can look at the two base stations next to each other are using the same channels. They probably will interfere with each other. So we want to move the sharing out to a further distance. What we're going to assume for most of the lecture is that the base stations and antennas are equidistant from each other. Okay. In reality, that's rarely the case because of sort of practical considerations of terrain and planning. So there's going to be some work to do to consider how we sort of get coverage, how we cover all of the area we wish to cover, and again do it in a way that has an acceptable level of interference. And then from the user perspective, mobility is now going to require a change of channel, a change of base station as you go from one cell to the next. Okay. So, typically you think of a cellular system as again being a collection of these base stations, and they all have a range. Obviously, there's going to be some overlapping of range, and typically, if you think of these as big circles, then you're just dividing the overlap. Again, the signal is propagating throughout essentially the whole physical space, but again, the power level at which it's received drops with some exponent according to distance. But at least as our first salvo, we're assuming that adjacent base stations use different panels. So we have here 7 channel sets and no neighbors use the same sets. Okay. So again, that's the coverage end of thing. Again, it's base stations are like access points that are trying to get you back into a broader network. Think of fiber, the telephony network, which is what we'll pretty much be looking at today, or back into a data network. But either way, the access points arrange for connectivity, but then your data has to be forwarded back through the network. And so you have a mobile switching center, which manages the connectivity back into the data or phone network. Okay. The mobile switching center will be connected to some region, some number of base stations. Okay, so again, the main issues are going to be frequency reuse. How are we going to assign the channels to cells to limit interference to an acceptable level? And this is a combination of actually almost geometric issues and sort of power characteristics. Power management, again, is important, so we need to decide how we manage the power levels for individual channels, and basically we have noise, so we have to overcome our noise factors, but we also don't want to cause undue interference, and we also don't want to we want it to be as easy on the battery of our mobile units as possible. So we'll say a few words about that, and then we'll say a few words about traffic engineering. So we've set up our cells in a certain fashion. We've given a certain number of channels per cell. How many actual users can you accommodate then? And then again, look at tricks to improve the number of users you accommodate. So, before we jump into how we're laying out our coverage, we'll just look at a simple example of what operations are needed within the cellular system. And again, we're going to be thinking in this case about making a voice connection. Pretty much the same things have to happen even if you are, say, streaming video. Okay. So we have our mobile users, our units, and they again communicate with our base stations, which forward that communication back through a switching center, which in turn forwards the communication back through the telephone network. And let's think about making a phone call. First of all. Okay. base station. We have, again, two directions, uplink, from the user to the base station, so the directions are relative to the user, and downlink is from the base station to the user. So basically, what the user is going to have to do is, first of all, make some connection with the network. What protocol there is finding a base station, and then through a suitable base station requesting connectivity. So that will link you into the network. Then, if there's incoming communication for you, the network is going to have to find exactly where you are. So the network doesn't track the exact location of any individual user, but rather it'll track a region in which they're in, and then it'll have to use paging to find the user if it needs to. For making our call, again, we will have to set up our circuit, so we'll reserve our resources end-to-end, and again, the sort of interesting bits for us are within the cells, and then, of course, since we have mobility from cell to cell, we have to change the resources we're using. We have to change the base station connectivity. So, again, we start by just connecting with the network, and in order to do that, we have to find a base station that we're sort of physically able to connect with. Okay, so the base stations broadcast control signals, and they broadcast their availability, and the mobile unit is going to scan them for the strongest signal. And when it finds the appropriate base station, a bunch of signaling has to occur between the mobile unit and now not the base station, but the MSC or MPSO, okay, to establish the right of that user to connect to the network, to be in the network. So you do validation of the user, and you also register the user location. That's at the level of the MPSO. So now the user is in the network in some sense. The network is tracking not at a cellular level, but at a higher level, the connectivity, the location of the user. Okay, so now if you want to send data, in this case, if you want to originate a call, then again, there's control information to negotiate for that connection. And so you request the connection over a setup channel. more multiple users can do it, will use the same setup connection. When you get the channel, the request is forwarded again to the MSC MTSO. Okay. So when you request that connection, you're requesting resources, but you're also indicating what user you want to connect with. And so then the network has to find that user, and it achieves that via paging. Okay. And the idea with paging is that a number of base stations, the MSC MTSO knows the location to a number of base stations, but not the exact one. So it'll send out messages, or all of the base stations send out messages to be responded to by the user you're looking for. Okay. So the paging message has come out. If the user hears it and accepts, again, it's responds to the base station, which forwards up to the MPSO, MSC. And then the MPSO sets up the circuit. So it allocates resources for the base stations. It informs the base stations of that allocation, and the base stations in turn notify the mobile users. Okay. So in the case of circuit switching, you've got resources reserved from the user to the base station to the MSC through the phone network, potentially out through the MSC to the base station to the user. So if the mobiles, the users stay in the same cell, then that's it. But they are mobile, so it's possible that they're moving from cell to cell. If they move from cell to cell, then handover has to happen.
When you say setup channel, is that a subdivision of one of the channels?
Yeah. Channeling in cellular networks is complex, but the idea with telephone networks in particular is that you have control channels, which are there to manage your connectivity, and even if that's just even in a packet context, you still manage connectivity through control channels, and then you have separate data channels.
And the setup would be on that control channel?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So anything that's not sending data is control and is sent through what we'll see is a rather large set of control channels. So handover has to occur if we're moving and we move from cell to cell. And the decision can be made by the base station and or the mobile unit. And well, we could even move farther back into the MSC depending on how far the user moves. But we'll get a simple case where we are just negotiating among the base stations. Okay. So the decision is based, well, obviously on the quality of the signal between the base station and the mobile unit, but it can also be based on other considerations as well, sort of network-based considerations. So if you are moving into a congested cell, as an example, then you wants to sort of try and delay moving into that cell as long as possible, because you're more likely sort of not to be able to get the resources you want. Okay. If you are, well, you're obviously going to also account for signal strength, and the most obvious thing to do is just to take the strongest signal. But, you know, think about walking along or moving along between two base stations, so equidistant between two base stations. Then, if you just take the strongest signal, you're likely to bounce back and forth between the two base stations. And there is an overhead to trying to set up or set up new new connections, so you want to sort of not be doing it or do it as infrequently as possible. Okay, so you want some additional consideration that will stop you from just bouncing back and forth with small changes in power levels. And so two possibilities is you add in the threshold or what's called hysteresis. So threshold just gives you sort of an acceptable level of power for the signal. So you change if you drop below the threshold and there's a stronger signal. So as long as your current connection is acceptable, you stick with it, even if it's not the absolute best. Hysteresis compares, so that's just sort of an absolute value. Hysteresis compares two signal strengths, and so you only change if the new signal is stronger by a certain amount. Okay. And so again, that takes care of that case where we're just walking, moving along between two base stations, because they're going to have roughly the same signal strength. You can, of course, combine the two and have hysteresis and the threshold together. And you can get this sort of complicated, get as complicated as you want then beyond that. These are simple techniques. We can add in our congestion factors. We can try to analyze our signal and decide, well, are we actually approaching a base station? Are we walking away? Are we moving away from another one? So you detect multiple signals and you try and figure out which ones you're going towards and which ones you're going away from, and obviously favor the ones you're going towards. Okay, so those are sort of the basic operations. That's, you know, some, that's sort of the type of thing you would have seen with GSM, just a few generations back at this point. But the approach is, you know, quite similar, you know, even with data. So the next question is, exactly how do we lay out our base stations? And so we want to do that in a way that keeps interference from the channel reuse at an acceptable level. Okay, and so as we've seen before, and we're essentially at this point for what we're looking at, assuming that everything is behaving in a very idealized fashion. And we saw that our signal strength was dropping as some proportional to some factor of the distance. Obviously, that's ignoring all our small scale. Well, or it's sort of aggregating all our small scale effects, and well, no, it's ignoring small scale effects. So we just have this drop with the distance. And so, we have our, obviously some carrier frequency, and this will be used in multiple locations. And so, you have your signal strength, and then you have your interference, and you can say that there's some acceptable level of interference relative to your signal strength. Okay, so here we say maybe 9 dB is acceptable. So what we need to do then is define our cell size. So if we have our distance between base stations fixed, then we would want to define our cell size so that we got no more than the acceptable level of interference. And so we're going to assume that we are placing our base stations at regular intervals. We're going to assume that all base stations are transmitting at the same power, and that signal is decreasing in a uniform fashion. So, again, we have to set up our system so that we will either think about placing our base stations far enough away from each other, and that will in some way define the cell radius, or think about having a cell radius defined by the power level you want to transmit at, and see how far away you have to put your base stations. So the idea, again, is that we're comparing our signal strength to the strength from other signals using the same channel but at a further distance, and this is referred to as co-channel interference. Okay. Now, generally, we're also assuming that we have distinct channel sets. Okay. And so, essentially, everything we've discussed except CDMA, where obviously if you're using some sort of frequency hopping, you're going through the whole spectrum at your disposal. Okay. So most of our discussion is going to be focused on these distinct channel sets and divvying up the channel sets amongst base stations, and then I'll just say a few words about how things differ for CDMA. And again, in terms of sort of the evolution of these solar systems, we started with distinct channel sets. We then moved to CDMA systems, and now we've moved back to OFDM systems, which again define these distinct channel sets. So, depending on what generation you're talking about, you know, one or the other will apply. Okay. So, again, our goal is to minimize the amount of signal interference, or actually to reduce the amount of interference to an acceptable level. And so the ratio of signal to interference is referred to as the signal interference ratio. So for our orthogonal systems, so our distinct channels, that interference is caused by different cells using the same channel. And so what we're going to need to do is, again, keep the cells sufficiently distant from each other. CDMA is more complicated in the sense that all of the cells are using the same channels. They're distinguished then by the codes that are used, the chipping codes that are used, but adjacent cells do cause interference. Noise is sort of in the background, and again, part of what we have to do with our power levels is modulate or is transmit above a noise threshold. Okay. So, basically, what we're going to do, again, is assign our channels in a way so at least neighbors aren't sharing channels, and then we replicate that channel sharing over and over again. Okay. And so, again, signal interference for any cell is coming from the nearest cells sharing the channel. Okay. So, quite often, if we think about sort of omnidirectional antennas, they're not radiating in sort of hexagonal or rectangular patterns. They're circular. Again, when we arrive at our cell shape by just splitting the difference along the edges. And again, obviously, the signal doesn't stop at the border of the cell, but it's, again, at some acceptable power level at these borders. Okay. The two shapes are common for cells. One is hexagonal and the other is diamond shaped. And hexagonal, well, it has some nice properties in terms of coverage, in terms of being able to replicate the cells. It's what's called tessellating, so you can achieve complete coverage without overlap by using this shaped cell. This tends to be a handler arrangement if there are no other constraints. In urban areas, particularly U.S. urban areas where you have grid systems, then it's more likely that your cells will be diamond shapes, reflecting, again, the possible locations of the base stations. But we again see that diamonds will have this tessellating pattern. We can arrange them for full coverage without any overlap. Okay, so we're playing off two factors. We've got our cell radius, and our cell radius is essentially defined by giving acceptable coverage at the edges, and we want to have the consideration is the level of power that we want to transmit at, and particularly that we want our mobile units to be transmitting at. So that gives us one factor, just what size our cell is. Then the question is, well, how far away do we go to reuse our channels? Okay, so how far away are our interfering signals? So if you fix your cell size, then obviously the farther away you move the interfering channels, the less interference you have, because it's decreasing with some power of distance. Okay. Now, what we'll see is that if we fix these, then everything else essentially is just a sort of geometric exercise. So once you fix the cell size and how far apart you want your base stations, then you have a geometric exercise to see how many cells you need to have sort of intervening, and therefore how thinly you have to spread your channels. And so that's the sort of fairly theoretical exercise that we're going to do. In reality, you can't place base stations to get this very regular coverage because of terrain, because of planning considerations. So frequently, it's actually quite a complex problem to decide where to place your stations and what power they should transmit at and what channels they should have, and that's frequently dealt with by simulation. Okay. So we have set of channels to use, and we assume that at least we don't want adjacent cells using the same channels. What we really need to decide is how far away we need to place cells using the same channels. But if we just pick some allocation, in this case we've divided our channel setup into three, then we can see that again we have to replicate that pattern of three channel sets and three cells over and over again. Okay. If the number of cells, if we choose a number of cells which again share the whole bandwidth, then the first business is cell cluster. Okay. And again, our clusters should tessellate. We should be able to lay down our clusters so that we have full coverage. The amount of interference is going to be dependent on the size of your cell and the distance between cells using the same channels. Okay, so we have two quantities. We've got our cell radius, and then we have a reuse distance, and the reuse distance is the distance between channels, between cells using the same channel. So if we have a certain signal to interference ratio that we're targeting, then what we'll see is that's going to define the ratio between our cell radius and our reuse distance. And once we have the ratio of the cell radius to reuse distance, that's going to define how our cells are clustered, how we share our channels. So again, the second aspect of just looking at the ratio between the reuse distance and the cell radius and deciding what the size of the cell clusters is a geometric exercise. Okay. And so we're going to look at that bit of geometry first. Okay. Okay. Now, what our goal is to define our distances in terms of intervening cells, and from there, the cell as a function of the cell radius. Okay. And this is quite straightforward. We start with our diamonds because this is really straightforward for a diamond shape. And so you can count the distance between cells is a function of the number of intervening cells and I, and then it can be and the cell radius. So And then for each intervening cell, you're going to be a distance of 2R, obviously. And then you get center to center, you have 2R, and I'm sorry, you have R and R, so it's 2R and I plus 1. And so that's nice because then we have everything defined essentially in terms of the cell radius. Okay. Now it's harder for hexagonal cells because if you go sort of directly, then you aren't going to go through any sort of even number of cells. Okay. And so again, it's going to be hard to sort of directly define our reduced distance as a function of our cell radius. But what we can do is we can change our coordinate system so that we're now traveling through cells directly, okay? So through the centers of cells, okay? And so instead of xy, we define u and v axes. So u goes up and down, so again, you'll see you go from center to center to center, and again, v goes on the diagonal. So again, you're traveling from center to center to center. Okay. You can now define the number of cells you traverse in the u and the v direction and reach any from any cell to any other cell in that fashion. Okay. So if you look at an example, then obviously G, you haven't gone from zero in the U direction, and that is the plus direction, so one in the V direction. S, you've gone up one, so plus one in the U direction, plus one in the V direction. P, you're going down. That's actually not right.
Would you have to go down to N?
Yeah. So that one's actually not right. I've noticed that for all these years. Because if you think traveling in the U direction, it would work if you traveled in the V direction, then the U direction not U, then V. And just for an interesting thing about the coordinate system. And then let's see if M is right. Yeah, you go minus one, and then minus one to M is right. So P would have to actually be down one. We're centered today. Okay, so P would be down. It is right then. Okay. Let me bring 3-0. Okay, if we start here, you go down two and over. Because that actually is right. Sorry about that. Okay. But anyway, so from the U direction first, then the V direction. Do you?
Actually, either way. About the
plus of the positive of that is that we can then again find these sorts of distances in terms of cell radii, and then work on from there. Okay.
Okay.
So, our cell radius is defined now to the corner, and so what we're actually traversing when we go through these is to the edges, so you have to calculate D as function of R, square root of N, you do that, square root of 3 over 2R. Okay. Now, we then can determine, again, how much we're traveling in either the U or the V direction. It's the difference between our U coordinates, and then, of course, sort of the intervening cells plus one type thing, which is the same as you got 2D plus the edges, but that's, again, accounted for in the coordinates, so it's just U1 minus U2 times 2D. And the same thing, V1 minus V2 times 2D. We have our values for D. So we can define how far we've traveled in either direction as a function of our cell radius. Okay, so
that's,
again, obviously not directly the direct distance, but we've got essentially
trigonometric problem, just finding the distances when you have two sides of a triangle and a bunch of angles. Okay. So,
we have our two distances, and again, we've got, you know, what the angles here are. So, we can, we have sufficient angles that we can now work out what our distance D is. Okay. And you can turn this into a bunch of right angle triangles, essentially. We add a little distance here. Drop this this onto the x-axis, so essentially convert back into our xy coordinates. And then the distance. Okay, we can do that as a function of now a right triangle. Okay, so if you grind through all that, what you get is that our Reeves distance squared, at least, is a function of our cell radius, and then J and I are the number of intervening cells. Okay, so I is the intervening cells in the U direction, J is the intervening cells in the V direction, and so, again, we have a relation between our
Reeves distance and our, or we've defined our Reeves distance in terms of the cell radius. So now
we can think about defining a minimum acceptable Reeves distance, And then asking, essentially, how far apart then are you putting your cells reusing channels? And so, and what we're doing is we're defining a cell cluster. So we're defining the number of sort of essentially intervening cells we need between our two points of reuse. And the cell cluster obviously is doing that in a two-dimensional way. Okay. This is, again, just geometric. Our cells are this size, our distance is this size, and how many do we have to put in between to get there? So we define a cell cluster of size n, and then the channels are shared among cells in the cluster, so we obviously have the total number of channels. We have each cell gets that total number divided by n. The clusters have to tessellate, so again, we have to define them in such a way that they cover the entire region. We refer to the size n as a reuse factor. Again, it's impacting how many channels you can allocate per cell. Okay. So we'll just look at a bunch of examples. This is straightforward. We just have seven within our cluster. And again, we see this roughly hexagonal shape, which tessellates. Okay.
Yes, there's four. Three. Essentially, what we're going to see is that we need numbers for which we can find an I and a J. Okay. Okay. So
we've defined our distance in terms as a function of the cell radius and the number of intervening cells. And so again, the question now becomes, if we have a reuse distance, how many cells do we need in our cluster to achieve that distance? And so, again, the reuse distance was defined in terms of the number of intervening cells. And what we see from that is that we need K, which is the number of intervening cells plus one, cells along one side of our cluster, and obviously along the other side of the cluster. So that's just let's just get over it again the way we defined our ratio. Okay. So we have k by k cells. which gives us, obviously, our cluster then has K squared cells, and so we need to subdivide our channel, or our channels, into the K squared subsets. So, what we see is our distance is 2kr, essentially our cluster size is 2k. R squared, then n is k squared, and so we can solve this to find k. K is d over 2r. So k squared over n is 0.25 d over r squared.
Okay, so again, it's strictly geometry. You're looking at the size of your cells relative to how far away you want. One's using the same channel, then you're just having to lay down cells to fill in the intervening distance. And so we can do the same thing for hexagonal cells. We get a little bit lazy here, in that we actually compare areas of cells and clusters. So we assume that our cluster is essentially approximating a hexagonal. So the area is in terms of the distance squared. And a cell, again, we can work out what the area of the cell is as well. And just because that's just a function of hexagonals and the radius of the hexagonal. Okay, so how many cells do you need to fill a cluster? And just the area of the cluster divided by the area of the cell. And we get that that's 1/3 d over r squared. But we've already, again, defined d in terms of r. So the size of our cluster is given by I squared plus j squared plus ij, where I and j are defined by that reuse, by the number of intervening cells in that coordinate system to achieve our reuse distance. Okay, so this gives us, again, an additional constraint. In that it has to be, in that it requires an integer value for I and j. Okay, so just dividing your two areas will give you any number, but it only works if we actually have I and j as intervals, so you may not get sort of exactly what you want. Okay, so I'm just... essentially, your cluster, again, was defined by these I and J values, so you can make your channel assignments on the I and J values as well. And so you essentially post, you for any channel set, you again assign it to an initial cell, and then you move I cells in any direction and turn 60 degrees counterclockwise and move into J. And continue doing that, and so on. Okay, so again, you move in IJ and keep moving, rotate and keep moving in that IJ fashion. Okay, so nothing too exciting about that. You can also just assign into a cell and then, again, lay down your other cells. Okay. So, again, given a reused distance and a cell radius, we now know how many cells we have, how we're arranging our clusters. But we haven't sort of directly factored in our signal to interference ratio yet. And that's where we need to go now. And so it should be pretty clear that for a fixed cell size, again, the farther out, the farther off you put reuse, the less interference. So the ratio of reuse distance to cell radius is referred to as the co-channel interference reducing factor, and it does just that. It gives you a measure of, again, how far relatively away you put your reuse. For hexagonal systems, this is for both sorts of systems, this is going to be a function of n, our cluster size. And so the change is obviously either if the distance changes, things are put farther out, or the cell radius changes. But both would have the same effect. So let's have a look at that. Here we have clusters of 4, and our D over R is also 4. And if we, again, fix that ratio and move one or the other, essentially we're changing the area of coverage, but we're not changing the basic configuration of the clusters. They still have the same number of cells per cluster. If we keep the cluster size the same and double the distance, for instance, keep the cell radius the same and double the distance, now you have an impact on your cluster size. And you need more cells than in your cluster.
So how do we now factor in actual interference values? We think that, again, our signal to interference ratio, what we wanted, would then define our ratio of distance to cell radius, so Reeves distance to cell radius. So if we consider any given cell, then we obviously all cells using the same channel set are interfering, but because it's dropping with distance squared, we assume that the interference is coming from the adjacent clusters. And so then you ask, well, how does power drop? Well, for the signal, it drops with 1 over R to the gamma. And for the adjacent clusters, it'll drop as a factor of our distance. So the interference is, again, however many adjacent clusters you have, and they're all dropping at b to the minus gamma. And our signal, again, is R to the gamma.
If we assume, again, only first-tier cells are significant, then for our hexagonal system, we will have 6 adjacent clusters. And so K is 6, and our signal to interference ratio is 1 over K, then D over R to the gamma. So again, get a minus there, and 1 over K over 6, our Reeves factor, sorry, cogeneral interference to the okay. So we can also relate our signal interference ratio. We can relate it to N. So the number of cells we need in our cluster. And again, just going back through, we know that N is related to D over R. Okay. So in this way, we've gotten where we wanted to go, given a signal interference ratio, so we want we require a certain signal strength relative to the interference. We now know how many cells we need in our clusters to get us there. After that, obviously the cell, the N, it has to respect the I and J have to be integers. But at least we can find a value of N and then work on that. Okay, so we're almost there. Once we have N, then the channels, the total number of channels get divided up among the
among the cells, and so the bigger N, essentially the less channels you're going to have available per cell. Now we'll see later on how channels per cell relate to users, but in general, the bigger, the bigger you have to make N, the less channels you have per cell. Okay. So, if we consider an example, here we're assuming that everything's dropping nicely with a factor of 2. We have, we want a signal to interference ratio of 10 dB. We have a certain number of channels available given by dividing the 20 megahertz by 100 kilohertz. Okay. So we get N by our formula, factoring in the signal to interference ratio, and 10 dB is also 10, so that's 20. And then we have to see if we can get 20 as a function of I and J. And actually, the closest we can try to get is 21. So you need 21 cells per cluster. You have 200 channels available. And so, again, that means that you have 9 channels, just under 10, so 9 channels per cell. Okay.
Okay. So, that's the most common sort of layout.
Again, CDMA is different, in the sense that we're thinking about doing frequency hopping, and so you're using all of the channels all of the time, but distinguished by our codes. So signal interference now comes most strongly from adjacent cells. And here we see it's a function of, and indeed you can get interference within the cell as well. So if your codes aren't orthogonal, you get interference within the cells.
It's now, the interference is now essentially a function of how distinct can you make the codes between adjacent cells. Okay. And as we said before, it also becomes a function of regulating our power within the cells. Okay, so that everything's being received at an equal level. And so if you do this, you can find your signal for your appearance ratio in terms of the various components. Okay, so basically, the more channels you have, the more channels you find, the harder it is to do that. So there's it gives you, again, a bound on how many channels, separate channels you can define. Again, I don't expect you to really grind through the mathematics, just be aware that the considerations are somewhat different. Okay, so that's a fair amount to digest, and so we'll call our break here and return and wrap up with our final topics. Again, traffic engineering is something that also requires a bit of thought. Okay, so we'll return in about 20 minutes.